Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Rod Tweet. He is the president and brewmaster of Second Street Brewery, and we are here to talk about beer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary.
So beer has a very, very long history. It goes back as far as civilization itself.
Yeah, they keep finding evidence that keeps going further and further back. But it is kind of interesting because it's been culturally significant going back 9,000 years.
9,000 years?
Yeah, something like that. It generally is believed to have started in Mesopotamia and a lot of other areas of Eastern Europe. And there's a lot of history there that's pretty well documented. Interestingly, in getting into more modern times, just in the U.S., before Prohibition, there was, I think, something like 6,000 small breweries in the U.S. And then, the ones that Prohibition didn't knock out, limped along, and then there was a consolidation about in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so we ended up with what the scene we had in the 80s, which was there was almost no small and regional breweries. It was just large production breweries.
So basically you had a choice of Budweiser and a variety of canned and bottled American beers and then imports from Europe, which were also pretty much mass-produced.
Yeah, and there was some, a few notable exceptions, some regional breweries that were still limping along, like Genesee and a few others. But yeah, it was pretty much that way. And then in the 80s, in the 1980s, is when the first sort of craft brewing pioneers started up. And that's sort of what led to what I do. And so it's kind of cool because, in the beginning it was viewed as some sort of a fad or a trendy thing, and there's nothing new about it at all. It was really just kind of getting back to what it was 100 years ago, even in the U.S., where, pretty much any town of any size had its own brewery. There was actually a small brewery in Santa Fe around the turn of the century.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was started by a German immigrant, and that's another story, and they eventually went out of business, but, Santa Fe had its own brewery 100 years ago, and then things changed. But
it is quite amazing what happened in the 80s, which is that the kind of military-industrial complex food where everything was homogenized and the quality was really low kind of went out of favor, and suddenly you had not only microbrews, but you had really much higher quality coffee and vegetables and extra virgin olive oil, all of that stuff.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's definitely a phenomenon that sort of extended to a lot of other different things. And it's interesting. It's a story. I hear different stories too about the reasons that beer became lightened up, so to speak. And one is that Anheuser-Busch had a major contract to supply the U.S. military during World War II, and it was being cut. They would use rice as an ingredient in their beer rather than all malted barley. That's sort of a significant difference between what us small brewers do and what large industrial brewers do. And anyway, that the soldiers liked that taste better, and so they just kept going towards a lightening trend in their beers, in both the ingredients and the flavor profile, and less hops. And it's kind of funny, they, like AB, for example, sort of denied that they lightened up the hop content of their beers until a few years ago. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal where they they finally admitted it, but and that they were going to start adding hops back. But we were definitely part of that whole trend towards putting the qualities back into things we eat and drink that mass production sort of over time, sort of eliminated.
Well, let's talk for a moment about how you make beer and what's in it.
Sure. Beer is, most you probably know, is usually just considered four ingredients. It's malted barley and hops and water and yeast.
Now, what does malted mean?
Malted means, well, barley is, it's a cereal grain, and most brewers don't malt. They buy their malt. And what a maltster does is they take the the raw barley, they steep it in water, which forces it to germinate. The barley thinks it's going to grow into a plant, and that starts in motion certain enzyme cycles that are important to brewers. And that takes maybe 5-7 days, and then they dry it, and they make it into a dried product. And that's the point at which a brewer gets the malt. And
so the malt is actually the germination of the barley and all the chemistry that goes along with that.
Correct. Yeah, there's, you know, I don't know, know how much you want to go into that, but yeah, there's an enzyme system there that is going to, under the right conditions, convert starch into sugar, and that sugar is the point of what a brewer does. The sugar is what the yeast is going to eat during the fermentation.
Right.
And small brewers typically use 100% malted barley for fermentables in their beer, with some exceptions. You know, occasionally they use honey or maybe malted wheat, and that's sort of a defining difference between, say, Miller, for example, which uses corn along with their barley, and Anheuser-Busch, which, and a lot of other breweries that may use rice along with the malted barley. Anyway, you just end up with a different product in the end, and so I think that's sort of a thing that a newcomer to small brewer's beer probably notices right away. And then,
because it affects the taste so much.
Yeah, it ends up being two different things, really, yeah.
Now, has the whole desire for organic and non-GMO agriculture and food and all of that also affected people's choices in beer?
It's starting to. The availability of, you know, like organic malt, for example, and organic hops has been really limited, but that's like a lot of other things, it's changing, and it's getting more readily available, and there's more hop varieties that are available. That's, I think the availability has been the biggest challenge with that, maybe more than price. But that's, it's happening.
So there are so many variables in brewing beer. Is it possible for you to kind of walk us, I mean, without having to go back to science class and all of that stuff, is it possible to walk us kind of through the process of how you get from the plant to the beer?
Sure, sure. So, we talked a little bit about the malting. Once that process is done, we buy our malt. We keep about 80% of our malt's probably North American, and the other 20% is split up between Germany, England, and Czech Republic. It's also about the same percentage for hops. So the brewer buys their malted barley. We have a silo that we store a lot of it in, and then the rest of it's specialty malts. It comes in bags. And then,
so you have this malted barley. I mean, they harvest barley off of a field. They dry it, sort of, and then
they let
it germinate.
Then they let it germinate, dry it again, kiln it. I mean, we have about 16 or 17 different varieties of malt around, and how long you kiln it is one of the main differences.
I mean, and kilning it really dries it.
It dries it, and if you take that process even further, then you start developing more flavor components. So, like, if you've been into my place, for example, if you go in there, there'll be 8 different beers and 8 different colors. It's not just a color either. They'll have a different flavor profile. Some of that comes from the use of these different malts that are treated differently during the kilning process. Some of them are germinated and kilned when they're still wet, so it caramelizes it, the sugars in there. And so then if you use that in the beer, the finished product's going to have a caramel palate to it. You know, it's really endless variations. I mean, you can get a strong caramel flavor. You can get a very light one. And so aside from providing the fermentable sugars, that's what malt does in the beer. And then hops, water's sort of a vehicle, and then hops and yeast being the other two ingredients, and the hops are a plant.
Really only used for beer.
Yeah, there really is no other widespread use for it. I've heard of it used a little bit in homeopathy and things like that, but yeah, it's really brewing, and it's a flour. We use the flour of the hop plant. And they're growing on these big trellises. Up most of it in this country is up in the Northwest. And it's a viney plant. It clings to these trellises, and then they harvest it. And the female flowers are what's used commercially in brewing. The male flowers are not used. And I guess there's flavor reasons for that. And then they're dried enough so that they don't, don't spoil. And then that's generally how a brewer gets them. And hops in a beer are what provide the bitterness. There's a boil after you've collected all this fermentable sugar. You collect it into a big kettle, and we boil it for about an hour and a half. And the hops you add later and later in this boil, you get more flavor and aroma and less bitterness. And as well, we have about 15 or 16 different hop varieties around, and they're all different. So
if you wanted a sweeter beer, then you would not use so much hops.
Yep, that would be one way of doing it, yeah. You hop it, your bitterness additions would be less, and you can meter in the bitterness that way. And that's a real critical thing, too, because you want, as a brewer, you want drinkability. And what drinkability means is that it's not, it's in balance, and it doesn't, sometimes a beer, if it's out of balance, it'll taste good for half a glass, but by the end of the glass, you know, it's too sweet or too this or too that. And so that's where the drinkability aspect comes in.
Well, I would think that too sweet and those kinds of things are really a matter of acquired taste and what you get used to.
Yeah, it is. And in some styles, you're going for sweet. A Doppelbock, a German Doppelbock, is kind of cloying sweet. That's what you're shooting for. So, there's lots of ways to go, and there is a sort of world of formal beer styles, within the beer industry, and a lot of them are based on old world traditions, and some of them are newer than that, and there's a lot of variety. There's hundreds of them. The other ingredient, the one that I think is probably the most interesting is the yeast that ferments the beer. And the yeast doesn't just get in there and eat the sugar and produce alcohol. It leaves behind a flavor component as well.
And is there a variety of different kinds of yeast that give a different result?
Hundreds, yeah. We use two different house yeast strains at 2nd Street. And one of them is really British. And if you know what British beer tastes like, it tastes a lot like that. It produces the ester profile that tastes British. It's apricot-y. Fruity, a little bit appley, and then we use another strain that's from the Pacific Northwest that's not quite as British, and we use both of those for all of our house beers, and then as well as that, we'll get in, and that's one of the things that's great about being a brewpub brewer is we're turning batches over so fast that we can experiment a lot, so we'll generally get 6 or 7 other yeast strains in over a year's time to produce even more beers, and they'll be distinctly different. And the alcohol, of course, comes from as a byproduct of the yeast fermenting that sugar. I've been asked on tours quite a few times, actually, when we add the alcohol. It's not added artificially. It's just a product of the fermentation. Yeast is a pretty interesting organism, and that genetically, there's labs that maintain the genetic integrity of them, which is really important to commercial brewing. And I think it's also kind of interesting that none of them are produced in labs. They all came from somewhere. They're all land race, so to speak. They all had origins someplace geographically on the planet, and somebody has maintained those and maintained the qualities of them. And that's really important for brewers.
Is it the same yeast you use in bread?
Well, they're related to each other, but they're pretty different, actually. They're pretty different strains. Beer yeast work a lot slower and reproduce slightly differently, too. I don't understand as much about baking yeast. The flavors are different. And brewing strains of yeast are extremely specific to brewing, and they've been maintained that way for, generations.
Generations, millennia.
Millennia, yeah. Yeah, that's a whole other subject that's pretty interesting if you're into that. But they all have a story, and there's all cultural aspects to them. And
we're talking to Rod Tweet, president and brewmaster of the 2nd Street Brewery. And actually, there's a new 2nd Street Brewery opening up, which we'll talk about in a little while. But when you think about all the different variables in beer, you've mentioned a bunch of them, the malted barley, the hops, the yeast. Then there's the water and the mineral content of the water and things like that. That must make a difference as well.
Yeah, yes, it does. And the water in Santa Fe is really quite hard. I've probably experienced, you know, the white scale on the bottom of a cooking
right.
kettle or anything like that. And that has implications in brewing. And for some styles, it causes some problems, but for other styles, it's that mineral content is good. So it's not necessarily a negative. It depends on exactly what the mineral content is, but the water here being hard is good for hoppy beers. It's good for beers that have quite a bit of color to them. Sometimes it can be slightly problematic for really light beers, but part of what makes a brewery's beer unique to that brewery, though, is the local water. That's part of it. And we don't really engineer the water here. We take the chlorine out of it. And it's just municipal Santa Fe water.
Right, right. Well, and that, as I understand, is one of the differences in regional beers, whether you're talking about the Czech Republic, Germany,
yeah.
Ireland, or Oregon.
Yeah, yeah. Czech Republic notably has extremely soft water in some of their famed breweries, and that gives them, their beers, a certain special hop palate to them. The Pilsners, the first Pilsners, which came out of Czech Republic and then sort of spread through Eastern Europe, were a product of some fairly unique water and a really special hop type. And those beers are still around, too. Some of them, Pilsner Kell is one that you can get easily that's been around forever. They basically single-handedly invented Pilsner beer.
Now, Pilsner beer, it's named after a region, but what makes something Pilsner?
The Pilsner arose when the technology for malting barley sort of advanced. Before, they developed ways of kilning the barley that were indirect. The heat was indirect. And previous to that, it had all been kilned over some form of open fire, and so it would take on more color, and there wasn't very much control. Before 1860, 1870 or so, most beers were probably some form of brown. And so when they developed this pale malt, it suddenly became fashionable and all the rage in Europe to have these pale beers. And so Pilsner was the lager version of that, and pale ales in England were sort of the ale counterpart to that whole phenomenon. And those beers became popular in Europe and sort of became the standard for a long time. Pilsner beer today is still, you know, hugely, hugely popular. But it's basically the color of the malt. And they also, a lot of them were pretty hoppy, too.
Now, what does ale mean? What's the difference between ale and beer?
Ale is a beer, but beer can be ale or it can be lager. So those are sort of the two dividing, the two family trees of beer is ales, which are fermented warm and faster. And ales usually have more fruitiness to them. An ale yeast lends more flavor esters. And lager yeasts ferment cold and slow or leave a cleaner profile, if you will. So lager yeast kind of gets in and does the job and gets out. It doesn't leave behind much flavor, which is the big difference between it and the ale. And we do, at Second Street, we're mostly an ale brewery, but we do about one lager batch a month. And we really enjoy it because it's, you know, not quite as routine as the ale brewing. And they're fermented at 52 to 55 degrees, whereas our ales are fermented about 69 degrees, and it's a long process. You know, it's like a 4 or 5 weeks from start to finish for a lager, and it's really, you can do a great job in 2 weeks with an ale. So those are the two big differences. Lagers are generally perceived to be crisper, more refreshing, maybe higher carbonation levels sometimes than ales.
And what does the term stout mean? That's another beer term.
Well, stouts and porters are done with roasted barley, which is actually not malted. It's just plain raw barley that's been kilned like they kiln coffee. And it's, when we buy it and you look at it, it's pitch black. that raw roasted barley is sort of the signature ingredient in the stout, and you end up with a black beer. And then porters, they both were sort of different now, but in the UK, when porters and stouts sort of originated, those two terms were used somewhat interchangeably. But they're heavy, and usually heavy, though Guinness isn't all that heavy. It actually has a great texture, but it's not really heavy.
It's considered a meal in some circles.
Yeah. Well, they do different formulations in different countries, too. The way Guinness is in the U.S., it's not an incredibly heavy beer. The stout that we do at Second Street is the more British version, and it has lots of chocolatey, caramely flavors in there and a little bit of fruitiness, and it's a really, really rich beer. And yeah, there's some calories.
How did you learn all this? Did you went to actually brewing school?
Yeah, I did. My background before that was mechanical engineering, industrial engineering, and really just was really enchanted with brew pubs and what they are. And like a lot of people in this business, I started as a home brewer. I home brewed for 5 or 6 years. And then
what does it take to set up a home brew?
Well, it can be easy or it can be hard, and some people make it too hard. But if you can buy extract, and that's the sort of good entry level way to start is to buy the malted extract. So that means you get to skip the mashing step in brewing.
Right.
And so that lessens the number of vessels, and a few hours off the day. And if in home brewing, if you're clean and you have healthy yeast and you use extract, you know, you'll make a good beer and it'll taste good and you like it. So it's not a bad way to start at all.
And I suppose they sell all the equipment for heating and fermentation and all that stuff.
Oh, sure. You can buy all of that stuff. And there's a shop here in Santa Fe, too, that's carrying that. And then if you want to get a little more involved, then you can get into mashing the first step in the brewing process as we do it, which is you take the malted barley and you crush it and you crack it into not as fine as a flour, but 2 or 3 pieces so that the water can you know, hydrate it. And then we steep it at a temperature between 148 and 158. That's where the saccharification range is. And then it's always kind of magical because in about 20 minutes it turns from milky, starchy-looking liquid into sugar. It looks like sugar. And that's the first step in the brewing process. And a lot of homebrewers do that too. And homebrewers bring us in beers fairly often. There's some good ones around here too. Pretty accomplished homebrewers. And so I did that as a hobby for 5 or 6 years, and eventually I just decided that I was going to quit my perfectly good job and go to brewing school. So I went to a school called American Brewers Guild in Davis, California, and did an apprenticeship program there. So
I would think that because beer brewing has been going on for so very long that the master and apprentice way of teaching would have survived.
Yeah, it has. And I went through a similar arrangement with that, where I had some classroom instruction when I went to this school. You know, you can do a 4-year university degree in brewing science if you want. That's not what I did. What I did was, it was a real apprenticeship program, and it was mainly about getting you into a brewery and to start, you know, they used to describe it as we're gonna give you brewing knowledge through a fire hose for 5 weeks, and then we're gonna stick you into a brewery, and that's how it worked. And you get into a brewery and you work under other brewers. I was at Humboldt Brewing in Arcata, California. They had a Scottish brewmaster there at the time that had a lot of training, and they were really good to me there, and I was, you know, it was sort of at my own expense, but it was great, and I learned enough to get started and in a commercial brewery, you know, all the mechanics in the beginning, how you clean a tank properly and all of that stuff, and then you move on from there, and it's kind of cool. I mean, you mentioned an apprenticeship, and yeah, it seems like there's not much of that anymore.
Is there in Europe?
In a lot of fields. Yeah, there is, and you know, everybody's got a slightly different story in this country, but pretty much all of them are where somebody, you know, worked closely under another brewer, at least for a period of time, and, you know, to learn their craft.
I would think that brewers also have their way of doing things, and if you put 10 master brewers together in a room, they would all argue about, no, you do it this way, no, you do it that way.
Yeah, well, you know, we have no egos, so yeah, it goes pretty yeah, there's plenty of egos, and everybody's got their own opinions, you know.
Well, not just ego, but real techniques. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah.
Study of chemistry, study of
yeah, I was sort of joking around, but yeah, everybody's opinionated. You got it. Everybody's real opinionated, and you know, there's always lots of agreement, and there's a lot of camaraderie in the industry in this country, and you know, locally too, and that's sort of a nice side benefit of being in the small brewing industry. But we have things like that throughout the year, conferences, and some of it's more social, and other ones are more oriented toward, you know, knowledge and education and all of that. But yeah, it's always interesting, and you know, it's a big subject. You really, I think there's enough to know that you're never going to know it all. You know, all you can know is more. So you know, there's always something new to learn, and if you're getting bored with it, it's, you know, it's your own fault, because there's always something new to do. I feel pretty fortunate because I'm doing what I wanted to do, which is brew in a brew pub, in a small brewery, and we don't really do packaging, bottling. It just happens to not be part of our business. So it's really just, we just sell beer by the pint at our outlet.
We're talking to Rod Tweet, president and brewmaster of the Second Street Brewery. Another thing we haven't talked about is when you have finished the whole brewing process, what you store the beer in. That also affects the flavor of it.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty straightforward for us. It goes from stainless steel tank into a stainless steel tank into a stainless steel keg, and that's it. Then we're serving it. So there's other things you can do, you know, that are done commercially, pasteurizing, filtration. Filtration's a good tool, but we don't filter too much of our beer, which leaves a little more flavor and color in, which is nice. But it's a really a fresh product that, and it doesn't really have an extended shelf life, you know. And our brewery is sized in a way that we can keep up with our demand, but you know, everything kind of clicks along the way it should, at least most of the time, you know, where we can make enough, but it's never sitting around very long. I mean, a 10 barrel batch of beer for us, which is 310 gallons, we'll clear out a batch of that at the brewery in two and a half weeks, which is way under the, well within the limitations of, you know, its shelf life. So that's what it is. It's really a pretty fresh product, minimally handled, except for hand trucking it from the brewery building over into the restaurant.
Right. Now, do you have connoisseurs who will come in and they'll taste a beer that you made that's new a few days ago and say, "Ah, this is different from the last batch"?
Yeah, almost every day. But it's, which is kind of fun, because you know, we have clientele that know some of the beers as well as I do. I mean, they've had it so many times, and we have beers that we do once a year. We also have beers that are on all the time, and then we have other beers that we'll do four times a year, and they'll wait for when that beer comes on. That's their favorite, and they'll often have remarks and, you know, complimentary usually, but we don't. You know, it's a batch process, and we don't blend them, so there is slight variations, and you know, I think they're pretty slight, but yeah.
But people can detect them.
It is part of what we do, in a way, because it's, we're not brewing 20 batches of a single recipe and then blending them to even out differences. You know,
and
it's
some
just
people
not
do
how
that.
We're set up. I think on a large industrial scale, it's all done that way, but it's just part of the character. What we do is, you know, it's done batch by batch.
Now, what do you think are the world's greatest beers? Have you traveled outside the country and done beer tastings?
A little, yeah. I have been to England, and I do happen to be a big fan of British beers and their whole brewing tradition. So, you know, I definitely owe some credit to that brewing tradition. And I love the yeast profiles. And I'm also, being from the Pacific Northwest, I would also have to confess that there's some influence there too. I love those beers, and I like hoppy, well balanced beers, and we do a fair amount of that. And I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to just name a couple, but let's see. Here in the U.S., I still think that Sierra Nevada makes some excellent products for ones that you can get anywheres. And there's great breweries all over the country that you can't get unless you go there too. So I have some favorites, sure, and some of the classic European pilsners, the hoppy ones, are great beers. Fantastic.
Yeah. Now, Germans make wheat beer, and I guess maybe there's wheat beer made here as well.
Sure. It's pretty common. Yeah, I mean, wheat beer as a style originated in Germany. There's, you know, the Bavarian-style Hefeweizen, which has the clove and banana flavors in it. There's Berliner Weiss, which is a little more tart and acidic from bacteria. And then there's Belgian wheat beer. Belgian wheat beer is my favorite of those, and that's the one we do at the pub once a year. And it's spiced with coriander and orange peel.
What time of year do you do it?
We try to work it in sometime in the summer, and every brewer uses coriander and orange peel. Usually those are sort of required, and then every brewer does their own thing, and I put lime peel and a little bit of cumin in ours also. And I think it's good. The lime peel comes through a little bit. It's kind of bright. And then there's another style that breweries in this country do a lot of. It's sort of referred to as American wheat, where you make a wheat beer and you ferment it with a normal ale yeast, and you end up with a somewhat more neutral product, but like Widmer Hefeweizen might be an example of that. And they're usually half malted wheat and half malted barley.
So since the 1980s, as you started out talking about, there has been a great rise in microbreweries, and that has changed the whole economic situation of beer in the U.S.
Yeah, our percentage market share keeps going up, small amounts at a time, but it does keep going up. And
what is the market share of microbrewery beer?
Well, it's still actually fairly small in the big scheme of things. I mean, if you compare it to all the imports and all of the large brewery beer, produced in the U.S., I think maybe around 6 or 7%, but I can remember when it was 2.5%, and so the percentage keeps going up, and I think you can sort of tell that when you see the large mass producing breweries try to emulate what they understand as a small brewer's product, you know, and they're good, you know, they're perfectly capable breweries. They can do a lot of things, but it's just not so much what they do, but they, you know, they try to come into the market a little bit, and I think that's because they're noticing that the market share is getting bigger.
Now, they're trying to do it through using different techniques, or is it more like putting it in different bottles and calling it something else, or
different techniques, different ingredients, and a more traditional process. I mean, the beers we make, it is technical and everything, but we're following a process. It's hundreds of years old. It's not, you know, we're not really doing anything drastic with it. With a lot of larger production breweries, their process is drifted into a different direction in some ways, and I don't mean to be in a critical way so much, but it has become a slightly different process. And so if you back that process up and go back to more of a traditional one, then that's one step, and then ingredients is another step, and recipes, I mean, it's a recipe thing. I mean, if you wanted to make a beer that tastes like a British pale ale, then you can't just use anything. You need to, you know, put together ingredients that are sort of appropriate for that.
Are there limitations of scale in what you can do? In other words, if you have just a gigantic, I mean, I don't know what all the vessels and receptacles are called, but are there limitations on how big a batch can be?
Yeah, sure, there is. And people talk about capacity of their brewery, and they talk about what their brew house size is. And we're a 10-barrel brewery, a 10-barrel system, which is about 300-gallon batch by the time it's taxed and ready to sell. And that's a really nice size for us. And we do about 1,200 barrels a year is our capacity right now.
But, I mean, if Budweiser decides they want to do something that tastes more like a handcrafted beer, can they use their gigantic factory equipment to do that?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I don't think it would work very well. I think, in fact, I've heard that they have smaller pilot breweries. Smaller for them might be a 50-barrel system or something like that. But because they don't want to make, you know, a bazillion gallons of something that they don't know how it's going to sell, when they can make a bazillion gallons of something that they know will sell. And
right.
And away they go. So
that's not so much a chemical or scale thing. That's like a marketing decision.
Yeah.
So how many microbreweries do we have here in Santa Fe? Well, Second Street is one.
Yeah, and there's Santa Fe Brewing Company. And there's Blue Corn Brewery, which is Rodeo, you know, up south on Rodeo and Cerrillos. And Blue Corn's basically a brew pub, sort of in the same segment of the business as we are. And Santa Fe Brewing, which is quite a bit bigger, is the bottling. They're a bottling packaging brewery.
So. Right.
They have a facility there also, but.
And so you all are friends with each other and share ideas and camaraderie, as you say.
Yeah, we all know each other, and across the state too. And if one of us runs out of ingredients, we call each other up and, you know, borrow something or buy something. We do that all the time, so that's a nice thing to have, definitely.
Before we got on the air, you were saying that Santa Fe, in a way, is more of a wine than a beer town. What's up with that?
Well, it's just there's a lot, you know, it's been more of a fine dining scene in some ways, and lots of very good restaurants, and they're great, but the emphasis is usually more on wine than beer, and which is kind of encouraging in a way. It means there's more audience to be had there for beer, and we've been treated very well since we opened in '96. We've been treated very well by the locals here, which is most of our business, and we've had great support. And always been, I think, probably more emphasis on wine in Santa Fe in particular. But I'm comparing that to like the Northwest or something.
When you talk about beer, it seems like the level of connoisseurship and technical variation and experimentation and really art and craftsmanship that goes into making it and enjoying it is pretty much probably the same or equivalent for beer and for wine.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it is. I have actually quite a few winemaker friends, you know, and we've gotten together and talked about this sort of thing. And I mean, process-wise, there's quite a few differences. And, you know, if you contrast one with the other, brewing is a little more involved engineering-wise. There's more heat in the process and things like that. On the other hand, brewers can almost always reliably count on ingredients that are going to make what they want and how they want to make it. You know, and winemakers, it's you know, it's agricultural. It's growing the grapes. And the winemaker has to fret about that, growing
right.
the grapes and how these years, grapes are different than last year's, and the sugar content and the acid content and inclement weather, you know. And as brewers, we don't have to really deal with any of those things. So
right.
I think they're, you know, both equally a challenge as far as producing the product and in appreciating it. You know, there are a lot of similar flavors, but there's a lot of really quite different flavors too. And you know, pairing wine with food is kind of an art form, and there's a lot of subtleties there that can. Pairing beer with food has not been quite as much emphasis on that as there has with wine.
Right, and brew pub food. I think the food at Second Street is terrific. I eat there quite often myself, and it's more kind of hearty and basic than fine dining in general. If you go to any brew pub,
there is sort of a expectation of that, I guess, with brew pubs, and that's good. We want our food to be really good. We want good ingredients. We want it to be affordable. And consistent, and you know, that's sort of our niche in Santa Fe is offering that all the time, and the atmosphere that we have, which is casual and different than a lot of other places, and the beers, of course, too. And but over the years we've expanded our menu items to include more salads and a few other things too, and I've got. My chef, Tim Lopez, is real capable and has done a great job adding specials, daily specials and things like that, too. We want it to be accessible. I think that's sort of part of what our place, our niche in Santa Fe is, you know. You don't have to have a reservation, or it's not too expensive, and
right.
and the atmosphere is casual. If you want to pull two tables together, people do it all the time. If you want to, you know, have a meeting for 4 hours there, you know, and have a couple of beers, you know, you can do that.
And play chess.
And play chess, or do some knitting. I've seen people do a lot of different things there.
Well, it does lead to a question of what beer culture is all about. I mean, beer plays a cultural role in virtually every corner of the earth.
Yeah, it's, you know, it goes back a long ways, and it does have, you know, real cultural implications, and I like that. I like that it's, you know, treated as significant, and it's, you know, something sort of special, and it should be that way. And I like it, you know, I like it to be accessible, good beer to be accessible to people, and affordable, and... You know, it's sort of an occasion for a lot of people when a new beer comes on at the pub, you know. I mean, they get really excited about that. So, and we have events throughout the year, too, and people get, you know, it's become part of something they expect from us to do these things. And it's been great for us, and, you know. So, the crawfish boil that we do in May, you know, has gotten to be hugely popular and really established in... So, in its own small way, it's, you know, we have some culturally significant things that we offer, and we try to encourage, you know, we do have a TV, but we sort of try to encourage the environment that pubs are known for, and we don't try that hard, actually, but it seems to have sort of happened, and that's what people like from us, and a place to have a conversation, and... We don't really do the sports bar thing. It's really not, just not part of what we do. And
beer does seem to be more of a guy than a gal thing, though. Is that true? Is that just a stereotype?
I think it's more of a stereotype, probably.
I was going through the variety of beer songs available on the in
well,
English.
Well, that's just looking for trouble.
Well.
And, yeah, and they're,
We'll play a few of them at the end.
Yeah, okay. We have a pretty strong female clientele, I would say. And a lot of women that like stout, actually, I've noticed. But so I don't know. You know, I think it... I know what you're saying. I guess there is a bit of a stereotype there, but...
What about... There's one question that I wanted to ask you, which is... I mean, the vast majority of people who drink beer and love beer and are connoisseurs of beer do not have a drinking problem. Occasionally, some do, and probably some of your regulars have a real drinking problem. How do you handle that?
Well, it's part of what you do as a liquor establishment is you have to, you know, it's we have a pretty sane clientele, and we don't have a whole lot of problems with that, thank God. But you know, if you're in the liquor business as a licensed establishment, you know, those sorts of things are going to cross your path at some point, and it's part of being in that business to know how to handle it. So keeping people safe, you know. Fortunately, it doesn't happen a whole lot, but once in a while, somebody has to be cut off for their own good. You know, it's the same sorts of practices that any liquor establishment, you know, tries to adhere to. And so, you're right. I mean, there is a responsibility there as the licensee, as the proprietor. That's what you're doing, is you're keeping an eye on that.
Now, you are the president and brewmaster of Second Street Brewery. We're talking to Rod Tweet, and our time is just about up, but you are opening a new branch of Second Street, so to speak, a new brew pub in the rail yard area.
Yeah, correct. And, in fact, I've got notes here in the back of my hand of when we're hoping to open, and it looks like it might be about the 21st
of
this
January.
Month. Yeah.
Excellent.
We started construction in September down there, and... About, I don't know, nearly 4 years ago now, I started looking around down in the rail yard area as a potential place to have a second outlet. And it's kind of a long story, but looked around into various properties, and eventually we started talking to the farmers market people, I guess last spring. And they've been real good to us and are thrilled that we're coming into their building. And so we're going to be located in the north end of the new farmers market building on the ground floor. And we have patio on the north side, patio on the west. And I think we're going to come out at about 100 people seating. More with the patio, but I think we'll make about 100 as far as occupancy. And we're not going to brew at the farmer's market building. About 5 years ago, I set up a new brewery at the Second Street location, and it has extra capacity. So all the beers will be coming directly from our Second Street location down to the new location, and we'll have a full restaurant there. And
with a similar menu?
Similar menu, yeah. With one notable difference is that we are going to be incorporating ingredients from the farmer's market.
Oh, nice.
To the extent we can, working with the seasonality of it and everything. So that's definitely a goal and part of the second location is to do that. But the menu will have all the favorites, you know, from the Second Street location. So if you want burgers or fish and chips, you can have that too. And same pricing, same beer pricing. And we're really kind of striving to, you know, do what we have been doing, just do more of it. And so that's what the second location is about. And it's a nice size. It feels good in there. Has a real good, cozy, warm feeling, I think. And it's turning out real nice. I'm kind of proud of it, I gotta say. And we're almost there, finally. And
well, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe, Rod Tweet.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Mary.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features the top releases of 2009 and an interview with bassist Joe Martin.
B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. All we need is a 10 and a 5 or a car and a key and a sober driver. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run.